Hey homies, this is Principal Coho Sam, and what you're listening to right now is the third to last episode of the Interho Uprising podcast. That's right, there are only three more IHU episodes ever! We've been having such a fun and insightful final season, and we're happy that you're along for the ride with us. And we'd love, love, love for you to be a part of our final episode. That's why we're asking you all to share your special memories or moments of IHU with us via voicemail. To share your thoughts, you can leave a voicemail to 404-491-9158. Again, that's 404-491-9158, and that number will be in the show notes. If you love this show or love what we've done for the past 10 seasons, now's your chance to show us how you really feel. Thanks for rocking with us. Let's get into the show. Welcome to the Interho Uprising, the podcast about sex, love, and dating from the perspective of me, Sam, one black, non-monogamish, non-binary-ish, feminist ho who lives in New York City and whose pronouns are they, them, she, and her. And I'm joined by...
You are joined by B, formerly Rodecca, sometimes Rebecca, a queer absurdist whose life is a series of coincidences that somehow landed them here. And my pronouns are she and they.
Bzzz. That's for your new name. I love it. All right. Every episode of the Interho Uprising works like this. Myself and my lovely rotating co-hosts talk about sex, love, and dating as it pertains to current events in the world, our lives, and yours. And occasionally we hit with interviews with insightful folks or do deep dive episodes on a topic of our choice. Today is one of those interviews with insightful folks type episodes. This episode, we're talking all about compulsory sexuality, what it is, how do we refuse it, that comes up later, how it impacts the way we view and interact with the world around us, and so, so much more. And we're talking about it all with a very special guest who we're going to introduce in just a bit. But first, Rodecca, you got some information for the people. I'm sorry, B, you got some information for the people.
It's okay. I mean, it's interchangeable, but I am trying to move over to B. So thank you for trying. I appreciate that. So if you would like to follow along with the conversation had in this podcast on social media, you can do so by using the hashtag Interho Uprising or tweet us Interho Uprising without the G on Twitter. We're also Interho Uprising on Instagram and Facebook.
Sounds good. All right, let's get into things.
Grandma! Yeah. Are you a hoe?
Today, we are talking all about compulsory sexuality with Sharonda J. Brown. Sharonda is a Southern-grown essayist, editor, and storyteller with special interest in media analysis, cultural critique, and horror. Sharonda is also the author of Refusing Compulsory Sexuality, a Black Asexual Lens on Our Sex-Obsessed Culture, and is joining us today to talk about it all. Welcome, Sharonda.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll just jump right on in. Tell us a bit about your story and what ultimately led you to write this book. Like, what is it about where we're at as a collective culture and in our understanding of sex and asexuality that made you say, I need to write this book right now?
First of all, my book was inspired by someone just straight up asking me to write it. So my good friend, Deshaun Harrison, who you might know, wrote a book called Belly of the Beast. It's amazing and important exploration of Blackness and fatness and other related things. And their book was published in North Atlantic Books, and one of the acquisition editors there asked for recommendations, came to me, said, hey, I love your work. Do you want to write a book about Black asexuality? And I was like, I don't know. Let me think about it. But ultimately decided, like, this is a book that needs to exist. There hasn't been a book like this before. And I was nervous as hell to be the first person to write something like this. But I ultimately decided that I could do it and I could do it well. But to answer your question about like our current state of society and how we like collectively view sex or sexuality, I started writing about asexuality a few years ago because I wanted to fill in the gaps that I was seeing. A lot of the perspectives were very white, as so often happens in discussions about sexuality. And a lot of the discussions were very basic, very asexuality 101.
Yeah.
And it came to a point where I was like, well, these conversations aren't really serving me anymore. And so that was what the book was born out of as well. Just a desire to explore things I hadn't seen other people talking about. And I want people to take what I wrote and go even further with it. Because I know I didn't explore everything. I know there's more to be said, but I'm just not the person to say it.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you for that. And that's like an awesome origin story. Like, that's how you know you're a great writer, when somebody's like, you got to write this.
You got to hear your voice.
But a little bit of Inner Hoa Uprising. This is like a cool circular moment, because this is actually our last season of this podcast. Oh. Way, way back when I think B was hosting their first ever season of the show, we interviewed Deshaun.
Oh. Yeah.
So this full is a circle. Very nice full circle moment. Yeah.
Cute.
That's cool. So listeners might be familiar with the phrase compulsory heterosexuality. Just a little backstory. If you don't, it was coined by, not if you don't know, Sharonda, I'm very well aware that you know, but for listeners, it was coined by writer and unfortunate transphobe Adrienne Rich. And essentially, it's this idea that heterosexuality is assumed and enforced upon people by a patriarchal and heteronormative society. So Sharonda, in your book, you take this idea like steps further and talk about compulsory sexuality. Can you talk a little bit about what this means?
Sure. And to be clear, I did not coin this term. Other people have been talking about this for a long time. But compulsory sexuality is essentially this belief that sexuality is something that we are obligated to participate in, and that everyone desires sex, and that it is normal and healthy and required of us to engage in sex and sexuality. And what that does is it creates this shame, sexual shame, for people who actually don't have that desire, or don't have a desire that aligns with what society considers to be a normal and healthy amount of sexual desire. So that creates a lot of pressure for people to participate in sex and see themselves as sexual beings, even if it's not authentic to who they are. So my book is about exploring how that idea of compulsory sexuality impacts everyone, but more specifically how it impacts people on the asexuality spectrum, especially Black folks.
In your book, you also talk about how ace folks are often thought to not be really queer, or to not experience any actual marginalization by other members of the queer community. That's wholly not true, and we encourage folks to dig into your book and learn about why. But specifically, we want to ask you about the ways that ace folks and allosexual queer folks are both negatively impacted by compulsory sexuality.
The way that both asexual and allosexual queer folks are impacted by compulsory sexuality is that there is this pressure to participate in a certain amount or a certain type of sex in order to be considered authentically queer. And that's just damaging for everyone, regardless of whether they're asexual or not, because there are queer people, especially young people, who have never had consensual sex, either because they simply have not had access to that type of relationship where they get to explore their sexuality, or because all of their experiences have been through sexual violence, or because they don't fall into traditional ideas of desirability and therefore don't have access to that type of opportunity to explore their sexuality. Like, there are all these reasons for why someone could be queer identified, have a queer politic, and simply have not participated in sex, whether or not they have that desire to. And so this idea that sex must be a prerequisite in order to be considered a queer person is harmful to everyone.
What kind of coalition building that can come of that shared experience, and how is that coalition building manifesting and where?
Well, I will say that I am not, I stay in the house, right? Like, I keep to myself, so I can't even speak much to where certain like communities are meeting and coalition building. I know that I personally am not aware of it, but I'm hoping it's happening somewhere. I know that there has been a history of solidarity between bisexual and asexual folks specifically, and that a lot of asexual activists used to participate in queer activism under the bisexual umbrella. And the reason for that is that bisexual and asexual people kind of were like, well, we're both not a part of this monosexual understanding of sexuality. And we don't fit under the lesbian or gay umbrellas, nor do we fit under the straight umbrellas. So they created the solidarity amongst themselves and organized together. And I see some of that solidarity online, but I'm not sure where there are like material spaces where people are getting together and coalition building. I hope they're happening. I just don't know of them. But that's my fault. It's not to say that they're not happening. It's just that I don't know things.
As someone who like also does not believe in the house like that, I appreciate that. Like coalition building, yes. I hope it's happening. But I'm not seeing it. But hopefully your book fosters it, you know?
Yeah.
So myths of hypersexuality in Black folks have been placed on us since the colonization of Africa. So we have things like the Mandingo trope and the Jezebel trope. And then even today we have things like the quote unquote fast ass Black girl.
Mm-hmm.
In Refusing Compulsory Sexuality, you talk about this sort of like odd space that Black ace folks occupy within the world in general, but also even within larger ace communities, cough, cough, white, due to the myths about our supposed hypersexuality. So can you talk a bit about how that shows up and the harm that it does to Black ace folks?
Yeah. So basically, we know that if any group exists, if a group exists, that group is going to have anti-Blackness in it, because that's how pervasive anti-Blackness is, even amongst other Black people. We have internalized anti-Blackness that we have to work through. So the ace communities are no different. There's anti-Blackness there as well. And it usually shows up in the form of people like not believing that Black people can be asexual or in the asexuality spectrum somewhere. And I theorize, and a lot of other people theorize, that that has a lot to do with this myth of hypersexuality that is attached to Black people and this view of Black people as one, like, giant monolithic body that is like brimming with sexual excess, which is in line with the myths about Black people in general, that we are just filled with excess, whether it has to do with sex or food or drugs or just anything else, that we're just greedy and we have to take up and consume everything, which is honestly a projection from white people, because they're the most vampiric race and they consume everything. And so, yeah, it shows up in ace spaces with people not believing us. There is this very famous asexual activist named Yasmine Benoit. She's a Black woman, and she also happens to be a lingerie model. And she very often gets accused of not really being asexual, even by other asexual people. And a lot of it is very thinly veiled misandry, and just the fact that they're not able to divorce this idea of a sexualized Black woman from Yasmine in their mind.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's interesting that you brought up like Yasmine. I just think of like all the different intersections of Black folks that this can affect. So like women, for example, or even like someone who's trans and ace, like with this the conflation of transness and inherent like sexuality and sexual deviance.
Right. And there has been a wave of transphobes, particularly on Twitter and probably also on Facebook, just based on how Facebook is. But a lot of them are like propagating this conspiracy theory that allowing young people to have gender affirming care is a way to make them into asexuals by allowing them to transition. It doesn't make any sense, right? To us,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I'm like, yeah. I don't get it logically. I'm not following.
It doesn't make any sense to us, but to them, to a group of people who see trans bodies as inherently sexual bodies and who see transitioning as an inherently sexual thing, in their minds, it makes sense that, well, if all these kids, and they keep talking about kids, right? Because to them, trans adults don't actually exist. And if we do exist, we're, you know, insane. In their mind, if these trans kids are allowed to transition, that means that they are losing their connection to a heterosexuality. And to them, that's the only kind of sexuality that exists, the only type that is valid. So therefore, in their minds, if we allow trans kids to have hormones or to socially transition. That means that they are not going to want to have heterosexual sex, which means they are going to be asexual. And so there's this connection between transphobia and acephobia.
What a leap.
That is very interesting and is very indicative of a much larger issue. And at the core of it is, you know, fascism and this mandate that everyone has to be cis and heterosexual. Everyone has to participate in the right kind of sex in order to be considered human,
right,
and normal and healthy.
Right. I'm so glad that you brought that point up, because for a sex, love, and dating podcast, we talk about fascism a lot.
I mean, that makes sense.
We can vouch for that. Yeah. it just fits. But kind of like on this kind of thought process of children and like both protecting the children, or we're saying we're protecting the children, but putting children at harm's way, I kind of want to reflect a little bit about this hypersexualization of Black folks and how it harms Black folks in general. So I think about how, like, we hear story after story of, like, young Black men saying that their first, quote unquote, sexual experience was with a woman who was much older than them, and how that's normalized and even applauded. Like, where does compulsory sexuality fit into that?
I mean, the thing about compulsory sexuality is that I think it is a cousin of rape culture. Like, I don't think you could separate the two, because if we are propagating this idea that sex is mandatory and it's something that everyone has to participate in to be considered human and normal, then that means that we can excuse sexual misconduct, even when children are involved, because compulsory sexuality tells us, well, that coupled with patriarchy and these really toxic ideas about masculinity and sexuality, all those things together tell us and tell men that it's okay for them to have had this sexual experience at such a young age with an adult, and that it's okay for that to have happened to them because they are viewing it through the lens of sexual conquest and a rite of passage for their masculinity. And depending on what lens you view it through, it can either be a violation or an achievement. And the lens they're viewing it through, they're seeing it as an achievement. And so it's very difficult to get men to understand that as the violation that it is, because they have to change the lens they view it through.
Yeah.
That's very difficult to untangle, and even like,
right,
that's like deep societal work, right? Like asking a whole bunch of people to confront like trauma and even realize it's trauma in the first place.
Right.
I was going to say, even hearing it, it's like, so how do we even fix that? You know, how far back do you go?
Yeah, it is. But because you also have to confront ideas of masculinity, you also have to confront issues of children's rights and children's autonomy. And also the very uncomfortable subject of childhood sexuality, which a lot of adults just simply don't want to address. They don't want to accept that children are, in fact, like full human beings, and that sexuality does exist in childhood, and that it can be possible for a child to be sexually explorative and sexually curious and still have been taken advantage of.
Well, kind of on the opposite end, it's for the past 3 or so years now, but especially this year, there have been national surveys that have kind of gone viral reporting that Americans are having less sex than in the prior years. Do you think that information maybe could be a hopeful signifier that societal ideas of compulsory sexuality have people in less of a chokehold, and that maybe people are feeling less pressured by society into having sex?
I mean, I think so. I think that absolutely has to be true for some people, but not for everybody. Because, I mean, I wrote about the moral panic about people having less sex in my book. And then was it last week? I don't know. Time is fake. That recently on Twitter, you know, this former congressional candidate, Alexandra Hunt, made this Twitter thread about how men are having less sex and linked it to the economy. And so I wrote another essay and was like, hey, I actually wrote a chapter about this in my book, and here's why she's actually fucking wrong. I think that for some people, absolutely, they are realizing, hey, this urge that I have may actually not be what I think it is. And it may just be me going through the motions. And we know this is true for some people because there have been studies. There's one study in particular I cited in something I wrote recently where men were interviewed about their sexual experiences, and many of them admitted to the fact that they perform a type of sexuality and sexual desire that they think is expected of them in order to maintain that image of masculinity and not necessarily what is authentic to them. And so they end up having more sex than they actually authentically want. They end up initiating sex even when they don't want to. And they end up saying yes to every single sexual opportunity, even if they don't really want to say yes to it. There are men who are admitting, hey, I'm actually forcing myself into these sexual situations that I don't even necessarily want to be in. And I'm doing this just to prove my masculinity. To who? I don't know. Whether to themselves or their partners, I don't know. So we have people who are talking about this. It's just not, I don't think it's hit the mainstream yet, that conversation. And I think it should, because a lot of people's ideas are going to be shattered. A lot, their ideas about masculinity and about certain sexual pressures will be shattered. But also something I cited in my book is that Cosmo did a study on millennial sex habits after this announcement of the sex recession back in like 2018 or 2019. They did a study and they found that millennials are actually having plenty of sex, but we're just expanding the idea of what sex even is. And we're pushing beyond the heteronormative ideas of sex altogether. So in those other studies, they're asking people about sex through this heteronormative lens. But Cosmo didn't do that. So people are defining sex in different ways. People are having queer sex. People are having solo sex, you know, and it's not always penis and vagina sex, which is important.
Yeah. Sure.
Those are really good points that you bring up. And I'm glad that you brought up the thing about Alexandra Hunt, because we actually had a question for you about that. But I think you kind of answered it. But I think it's like, super interesting that, you know, in talking to these men, they're basically saying, like, I'm having sexual experiences that I don't necessarily want to have, and that can lead to negative feelings. But like Hunt proposes that having less sex, bar none, is going to lead to, like, she says, like, nihilism, depression, and sitting out of the workforce.
Yeah. And that is actually what was at the core of her argument, because even though she tried to backtrack later, Alexandra Hunt was really like pushing this very thinly veiled incel logic.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that sexual prowess equates to social and financial success for men, which is just patriarchal mythology. And it's incredibly damaging to men and everyone who engages with men. So first, men should not have to measure their entire worth by the amount of sexual encounters they have. And second, we need to directly challenge the beliefs built around a traditional idea of masculinity that tells men that sex is the only way for them to access intimacy. Because even that myth doesn't serve them, because it also comes along with messages that men aren't allowed to be fully vulnerable during sex either. So in what space are men really allowed to be vulnerable and really have the intimacy that they crave if they can't even get it through sex, which is framed as this ultimate prize where they are supposed to get those things? Patriarchy is built up of all of these lies. And I think a lot of men are realizing that they've been lied to and realizing how empty patriarchy actually is. A lot of the things that patriarchy tells men that femininity will steal from them are things that traditional masculinity actually steals from them.
For sure. And this makes me think of the sex positivity movement and its flaws, and kind of just seeing things crop up under the guise of sex positivity, under the guise of feminism that doesn't allow for space for men to feel vulnerability and like to say no and to take breaks during sex. Me and Rebecca did this episode about
exactly what I was like nodding my head about.
This TikTok that went viral with this guy in a yellow do-rag. That's what I remember about him. And he's kind of talking about kind of being berated by his partner for like finishing early. And things like that. And so do you see things do you see the ways in which the sex positivity movement, I guess, as it exists on like super like spaces that lack nuance, like Twitter and TikTok and things like that, kind of co-opting sex positivity and turning it into compulsory sexuality rhetoric?
Yeah, for sure. So I think people say sex positivity and mean different things, first of all.
Yeah.
Because when I first learned about what sex positivity was a few years ago, I was like, oh yeah, this sounds great. When I read it, I was thinking more about like sex neutrality. But sex positivity is really just supposed to be this idea that combats the idea of sexual shame for anyone who wants to engage in sex, and that sex is a good thing for those who want to have it, and that you shouldn't be ashamed of your sexual desires, regardless of what they may be, as long as they are ethical and safe. But then people turn sex positivity, like you said, into this other vehicle for compulsory sexuality. And I realized that actually was not good for me a few years ago, because I was like, well, yeah, in order for me to be sexually liberated and sexually free, like I have to engage in, you know, all of these things that people tell me or what I'm supposed to engage in. But then I was like, oh, that's actually not going to work for me. That doesn't mean it won't work for other people, though. And I think people have such a hard time thinking outside of themselves and outside of their own experiences that they don't realize that sex positive, what is positive for them is not positive for other people, and vice versa. I never saw that TikTok. It was really fucked up.
Yeah, it was really interesting. It was really interesting. I mean, there's definitely like conversations to be had about the way that men are socialized, like not, I guess, taking the time to pleasure their partners. And that's definitely something that we talked about when we had a conversation about it.
Yeah.
But the backlash was very much like,
yeah,
make me come or leave, nigga. And it was like, okay.
You know,
I think that there's like a bit of some conversation to be had.
Right.
Like with your sex partners.
You wouldn't think this would be controversial, but you know, you're supposed to enjoy the experience, right?
Yeah.
Seems to be lost on a lot of people. It's also just for relationships in general, like you're supposed to actually enjoy spending time with the person that you're in a relationship with.
Yeah, exactly.
People don't get that though. So like, I don't know.
It's a very like confrontational thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, when did it start from being like something where it's mutual pleasure to like, we're just fighting, you know, the whole time through, or like, I don't know. It just like, it got lost in translation somewhere.
Or where it's like a competition where it's like still nutted though, kind of thing.
Yeah. There's this inherent like power struggle when people talk about sex.
Yes.
And I don't like it.
Yes.
And so I just sort of like excused myself. I was like, I would like to be removed from this narrative, and just sort of muted a lot of words on Twitter. And it was like, I don't want to be a part of this. It's not my business. I'm going to ignore it.
In my head, you're like that Viola Davis meme where she and grabs her purse and you're like, this is allosexual
I'm good.
Business.
Just walks
out. I don't want to be in this allosexual business right now.
But it's not even necessarily how, like, I want to make it clear that there are a lot of asexual people who have sex with their partners or with multiple mm-hmm. partners. People enjoy sex, mm-hmm. desire sex. Asexuality is a spectrum, and people fall on different places on that spectrum. What a lot of people don't understand is that asexuality is about how you experience attraction and desire, not who that attraction or desire is aimed at. So on the spectrum of people, there is absolutely a group of people who are both asexual and sexually active.
And then there's a group of people who are problematic within that.
Yes, exactly. Whatever, if a group exists, there are some people in a group who are problematic and who have very shitty ideas. And that's why I say to myself.
That's where the purse grab comes in. Got you. Thank you for clearing that up.
Yeah.
Well, we had a little joke. Let's circle back to fascism. You know, let's just get dark.
Okay, great.
Let's get dark. Let's get there fast. Our conversation with Sharonda is about to get even juicier. We're about to get into my fave topic, my fave least fave topic. But first, in true podcast fashion, on this last season of Inner Hall Uprising, we gotta take a moment to hear a word from our sponsor. This episode of the Inner Hall Uprising is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know what's weird? Living in a world that is increasingly uncertain and being tasked with decisions about your future. That's how I feel about life sometimes. And when I do, I sometimes think, man, I wish I had like a manual for this shit. But when you don't have a manual, therapy can be the next best thing. Life doesn't come with the user manual, as you know, unless you're hiding something from me. So when it's not working for you, it's normal to feel stuck. Navigating any of life's challenges can make you feel unsure, whether it's a career change, a new relationship, or becoming a parent. Therapists are trained to help you figure out the cause of challenging emotions and learn productive coping skills, which makes therapy the closest thing to a guided tour of the complex engine called you. I'm about to start calling myself that. If you're looking for a therapist to help you in this weird journey we call life, you can try BetterHelp. BetterHelp has connected over 3 million people with licensed therapists. It's convenient and accessible anywhere, 100% online. Therapy has been a game changer in my life and helping me grasp with some really huge life changes like new jobs, breakups, and even deaths. As the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist at any time. It could not be any simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/IHU. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/IHU, betterhelp.com/I-as-in-inner-H-as-in-ho-U-as-in-uprising. Let's get back to the show. So I think that there's a lot of signifiers that fascism is on the rise, at least in the United States. So we see things like big things like the overruling of Roe v. Wade, or like the anti-LGBTQ laws, or just sentiment that's cropping up in states across the country. But then even on social media, we see things like people yearning to be like a traditional wife, like the whole trad wife memes that are happening, or just this wanting to implement traditional family values and like harken back to the quote unquote good old days. So definitely curious to hear your thoughts about this. Fascism is at once both pro-baby and anti-sex. Mm-hmm. How might you foresee the pro-baby, pro, you know, nuclear family hunker down sentiment affecting ace people and aro people? I know we haven't brought aromantic folks into the conversation, but let's do that now. How do you see that happening? How do you see that playing out?
So, well, first of all, anytime I use the word traditional, the subtext is absolutely colonizer.
For sure.
White supremacist, you know, all that. One thing that I'm gonna make this specific to Black people because it's what I do. One thing that I consider writing about in my book, but ultimately chose not to because I believe this is an intra-communal issue that deserves its own space. But there is immense pressure for Black people to form nuclear families and have children, especially Black women or people society views as Black women. And that pressure comes from wanting to counteract white supremacy and white supremacist violence against Black people. It's framed as this way to counteract genocide. And that that's something that should be deeply interrogated, right? Like the fact that the state is invested in killing Black people is absolutely a problem. The answer to that problem is not to force Black people to give birth to more Black people. But that seems to be the first thing that a lot of people reach for. And the reason I say this is an intercommunal conversation because this is also happening right alongside respectability politics, which shame people who do have a lot of children or more children than society thinks they should have, especially if they have them out of wedlock, especially if they get pregnant as teenagers. Like, that we get all these contradictory messages, and all of those messages are rooted in anti-Blackness. So I once wrote this essay a few years ago about my decision to be intentionally child-free, and a Black man called me an agent of white supremacy. Oh my god. After the initial shock.
But won't they? Yeah. Won't they just do that?
After,
I can't even be surprised anymore, right? But
after the initial shock, I had a good laugh because I just think it's funny that I'm an agent of white supremacy because I don't want to be pregnant. That's wild to me. But it was both hilarious and sad because the essay specifically explored how Black men have vied for reproductive control within Black communities, often denying the rest of us bodily autonomy because they want to use Black babies as fodder in this fight against white supremacy. And it's like fucked up any way you look at it. So this prescription of traditional family values and creating a nuclear family for Black families really tries to present Black patriarchy as an answer to white supremacist patriarchy. And in both of those scenarios, people of marginalized genders and sexualities are going to be under someone's boot. Mm. So it's just recreating the same structure and just, you know, relegating it to Black communities. So people who are not interested in this heteropatriarchal model of family making, whether they are asexual or not, will always be framed as deviant, as abnormal, as being like counter to the cause, because people have decided that creating more babies is the answer to a number of societal issues, whether that be combating white supremacy, creating future Black revolutionaries, making sure the economy doesn't crash, making sure the population level doesn't fall below a certain point. There are all these issues that people are just like, oh, the answer to that is just to have more babies, instead of looking at how to make the world better for the people who are already here. And the people who want to have children, to be able to bring those children into a world that is not constantly trying to fucking kill them.
Like, maybe it's good for one child to have multiple aunts who don't have kids.
Maybe.
To take care of them.
Yeah,
maybe.
Like, kind of just like reimagining the world instead of recreating a white supremacist patriarchy.
Right. So like the fact that asexual people are less likely to create what we consider traditional families means that asexual people are going to be framed as the deviant ones within that pressure to create traditional families. Because we tend to exist in more queer structures where we are life partnered with someone who is a platonic life partner. Or if we do have kids, it's sometimes not in the nuclear family model. But also, Black people, the deviant broken family narrative that we have was created by comparing white family structures to Black family structures. And there were absolutely like measures taken by white Americans in order to construct Black family making as deviant and other. Mm. And so now we have these respectability politics telling us that if we just created families in the right ways, then certainly Black people will be able to get ahead, completely ignoring the fact that white supremacy exists so that that will never happen, regardless of what our families look like, because it's not about what we do. It's about the fact that we just exist.
It's us.
Yeah. It is us.
Yeah.
It's just the idea of like normal in general. Like, where did that come from? And why do we keep trying to go somewhere that if we just be ourselves, that can be the new normal, you know?
Right. I mean, just the very concept of normal itself is built on white value systems. And what
in everything?
If white, yes. This is right. Like, if I
and gender and body size, and
all of that. Yeah. Why do I want to be seen as normal to them? Why does that matter?
Yeah.
Even if they do see, they're never going to see us as normal, first of all, because we're Black. But even if they did, they're not going to treat us any better. At the end of the day, if they want to throw someone under the bus, it's going to be us.
Mm-hmm. First.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, so you might as well, you might as well just do whatever the fuck you want. And if that includes not having a nuclear family, then that's fine.
In your book, you talk about the narrow idea of a healthy sex life and how that thought isn't usually particularly concerned with one individual person well-being, and instead is used to uphold a standard or normalcy, which is exactly what we were just talking about. And we've thought about this concept a lot when it comes to, well, I have to my sex life, being someone who is experiencing and has experienced low desire. So how have we societally defined low desire in the first place? And what's the bar? Like, how do we throw that bar away in the first place?
So we have defined low desire, first of all, based on the desires of cis heterosexual men. So there was a study that showed that when women are diagnosed as having low sexual desire, it's only low in comparison to the amount of desire that their male partners have. And in situations where women have higher desire levels than their male partner, they're actually told that they have too much sexual desire. So it's not even necessarily about the amount. It's about how much women experience desire relative to the men they are partnered with. And there was a very cisnormative explanation because the studies I read were cisnormative studies, and they didn't, to my knowledge, or from what I've been able to find, they didn't talk about how this impacts people who are not cis, straight men and women. So all of our ideas about normal sexuality are built around patriarchal ideas and literally phallocentric ideas of sex and desire.
And even if you think about queer people and like what society deems normal, it's like that queer people are hypersexual anyway.
Yeah.
Right.
Compared right. to.
Yeah. And also something I've seen that I haven't spoken on because I didn't feel like it was my place. I'm not going to say everything that I think, but I will mention it. I have seen some lesbians here and there. TikTok thought I was a lesbian when I first got on it.
TikTok still thinks I'm a lesbian. And I'd be in there like, look.
TikTok too thinks I am a lesbian.
TikTok definitely thinks I'm a lesbian.
And I was like, this is fine. I'm a little bit gay. I can sit here. It's fine. Mm-hmm. So I was seeing all these videos from people who identify as lesbians. They were just like, you know what? There's this narrative that lesbians have sex for like 14 hours and I can't keep up with that. And it's stressing me out. And I was like, well, that's sad.
Yeah.
You shouldn't feel like you have to have sex for a certain amount of time in order for you to really have pleasurable sex. And to feel like you were like living up to these expectations for a certain amount of, I don't know, sexual stamina or whatever. And I was like, well, I had never thought about that before because I didn't realize it was an expectation for lesbians to have sex for so long. And like, what must it be like for you to be someone who identifies as a lesbian and to not fit into that stereotype? And I was just like, oh, that's just another way that compulsory sexuality is sneaking in and getting into our brains and telling us, like, this is how you're supposed to have sex. And if you're not having sex this way, you're not doing it the right way.
Yeah. And speaking of, like, doing it the right way or even, like, veering from what is considered a normal desire, like for me personally, when I started experiencing quote unquote low sexual desire, or really just desire that was different than like I thought I was supposed to have, I immediately jumped to there was something wrong with my body and like, do I need help medically? I remember I said on the show, I was like, I don't know if this is like an age thing. Meanwhile, it was just like I wasn't attracted to that person and I didn't want to do anything with that person, but I didn't even jump there. I immediately was like, I just felt like something was like that I needed to get help in some type of way, as opposed to just like listening or checking in with myself. Right. And this is actually a theme that you touch on in your book. So would you be able to talk a little bit about the medicalization of low desire and how that impacts ACE folks?
Sure. Well, first of all, sexual desire is not something that is static, first of all, which is something that we don't learn.
Which is what I'm learning now.
Yes. There's a natural like ebb and flow, a natural rise and fall. You're not going to feel the same amount of consistent sexual desire for your entire life. For most people, that is just not true. And so it's completely natural for you to feel more sexual in some moments than you are in other moments. But we live in a culture that medicalizes anything that's not considered normal.
Mm-hmm.
And we also live under healthism, which it tells us that our health is our own personal individual responsibility. And if we're not working towards being more healthy, then we don't actually, we're not actually worthy of that health anyway. And so this idea that having a consistent sexual urge is healthy is detrimental to everyone, but especially ace folks who might not have a sexual urge at all, or who might only have experienced quote unquote low levels of sexual desire. And so it harms ace folks, but it also harms allosexual folks who don't experience a consistent level of sexual desire, whether that be to just their natural ebb and flow or to the fact that they're simply not attracted to their partner anymore. For straight women especially, this has been an issue. And people talked about this a lot during the pandemic, weaponized incompetence that a lot of straight men display. So basically, straight women end up being in relationships with men who act like they're children instead of like they're adults. And so they lose their sexual desire because they're parenting their partner. And it's hard to have sexual attraction to and desire for a person that you're parenting because you're not supposed to be parenting them. And so there's this disconnect between who this person is and who this person is supposed to be, who they are in your mind and who they actually are in real life. And so how are you supposed to maintain a sexual relationship with someone who is not acting like an adult in the household?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. That actually just makes me think, definitely everybody like go out, cop Sharonda's book, read it. But like you have this whole section about women and frigidity. And that makes me think like, of course, there are women who experience low sexual desire. There are women who might be ace. And then maybe there's women who are just like in relationships with men who don't wash their ass. And
exactly.
Like, that doesn't turn me on.
Exactly. Not at all. And there was a point in that chapter where I mentioned the fact that Sigmund Freud, everyone's favorite psychoanalyst, was one of the people who was just like, actually, cunnilingus isn't real. Like, you shouldn't be focusing on the clitoris during sex at all. That's deviant. It's immature to focus on the clitoris during sexuality. You should only be having penis and vagina sex. And if you can't orgasm from penis and vagina sex, then there's something wrong with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just like, when you read all of these like psychologists and psychoanalysts from the 20th century and earlier, it's just like very, very apparent that they all hate women. And they just decided they were going to take their feelings about women and hating women and just create an entire field of science in order to justify their hatred of women. And their absolute refusal to learn anything about women's sexuality and how to please them in any way.
Yeah. Closely related to the entire field of science that just said, like, Black people are backwards.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. Early science was just...
They had opinions and they were all wrong.
It was literally just white men sitting around being like, you know what? I don't like these people. Let's write a book about how fucked up their bodies are. It's not us. We don't have to change
anything.
Couldn't
be us. Couldn't be us, yeah.
So after we talked about that, it did make me think about a couple of times. I was like, man, I was with somebody who was just not watching. But in general, I've said, yeah, I know. Thank you. It was a little sad, but I'm not with
my condolences. Thank you. Congratulations on no longer being in that space.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Mm-hmm. But I still experience low desire now. I don't.
And so that's fine.
I was just about to say.
And I think we should get away, like, I think we should just do away with the term low desire anyway, because it's just desire.
Yes.
It doesn't matter, like, where it falls on the scale. It's just your desire.
Yes. So my desire has changed.
Yes.
And, like, it significantly is something where I'm, like, rooted in it. I'm okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
But it has also caused me to question my sexuality and identity. Just because we have words for things now, and I love to, like, know more about myself. So for folks like me who might exist in this space of, like, questioning things, where would you say we go from here? Like, are we ace? Are we demi? And how would I explore that, or we explore that?
I mean, I am someone who frankly doesn't care about labels. Like, I chose the label asexual because it was the one that most closely fit what I was experiencing. But really, I don't think you should focus on the label. I think you should just focus on reading other people's experiences and realizing the fact that you are not alone in that experience.
Yeah.
And that is the only thing that matters. Normalizing the experience that you have and knowing that it doesn't align with what is considered normal, and that is okay. But if you really want a label, some people really love labels, and that's fine. There are entire glossaries out there. There are a lot of micro labels under the asexual umbrella. I can't tell you a single one of them outside of demisexual because there are a lot, and my brain just won't commit all of them to memory. But yeah, definitely go hang out. I think Avon has that glossary. Read all of those terms if you really want to find a label. And I guarantee you, you will find a label that describes you. I am just apathetic about all of it. I'm just like, I am what I am. And I don't know what label describes me best, but I know which ones don't. And that's enough for me.
I feel like I just like alliteration, but I'm hearing an apathetic asexual podcast from Sharonda in the future.
Yeah, I once saw somebody, because I'm also very apathetic about gender.
Yeah.
I saw somebody say once, I'm asexual, aromantic, and agender. I took a look at all three and just said no. And I was like, yep. That's me. No, thank you.
I don't want any of it.
More for y'all.
I appreciate that. As we're wrapping up, I want to talk about one like really fun part of your book that involves your reading of, and I just like love her to death, our Afrofuturistic foremother Octavia Butler through an ace lens. So Butler is like, this is something that I believe just from like the zeitgeist, but people often believe her to have been a lesbian, but your chapter on her actually complicates that commonly held notion a lot. So I'm just curious, what was it like doing like this ace reading of Butler?
Okay, so I was researching Butler for something else entirely. I don't remember. It was probably about Afrofuturism. But I came across her interview where she said that she went and actively investigated her sexuality because there were so many people who were calling her a lesbian. And so she couldn't figure out, maybe I am. Let me go talk to some people and see if I can figure out if I'm a lesbian. But she came out on the other side and was like, you know what? I'm just a hermit. That was her word for it, a hermit. And I was like, I like that. But the way she spoke about herself just felt very familiar. And it felt like something that other people within the ace spectrum can relate to. So I immediately thought, it definitely sounds like she is on the ace spectrum. I can't say for sure. She's not alive for us to ask her, unfortunately. But I just started digging deeper. And the more I read, the more it made sense. And in my chapter, I'm very careful not to definitively name her as asexual because I can't do that, or aromantic. I can't do that, but I can say, hey, everyone or everything I read about her places her firmly in the lesbian box. And that is unfair. Not only because she specifically and explicitly said that she is not a lesbian, but also because it's not fair to her true experiences in the way that she talked about herself. And I believe that people have placed her into this lesbian box because they don't know where else to put her. And so it turned out to be that the reasons people called her a lesbian were because she never married. She never had a public relationship with a man. And she presented in the way that we would today probably call mask presenting. And so all these things sort of like spelled out lesbian to people. And I was like, I could see how they got that. And I probably would believe that if it weren't for the fact that she specifically said she was not a lesbian. And so I got a little bit annoyed with it. But then I was like, let me investigate the reasons why people are so like adamant on calling her a lesbian. And I really just wanted to focus on the fact that there are other possibilities for Octavia Butler, as well as Langston Hughes. And a lot of other people that we probably will never know about, who have existed on the spectrum of asexuality and aromanticism and who were never able to claim those things because they just didn't know that there was a place for them on that spectrum. And this is why I know the value of labels, even if I don't necessarily want to use them for myself, because it helps people to find communities and it helps people to know where that there is a place where they can belong. And I think that if Octavia Butler were alive today and someone came to her and said, hey, you called yourself a hermit, but here's this spectrum of people who share experiences with you, who might align with some of the things you've said about yourself. And maybe you want to investigate and see if that fits you. And I think it's possible that Octavia Butler might have looked at it and said, hey, you know what? That does fit me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just think I think it's important for us to give people that possibility.
Yes.
Even if we can't give it a definitive name. Just being able to say, hey, it's possible that Langston Hughes was asexual is enough for me. And like Langston Hughes's his primary biographer wrote two whole volumes of Langston's biography. And at several points was like, you know, I think Langston Hughes might have been asexual. Seems like he was asexual. And still people were just like, no, he was gay.
Like people just have asexual blinders on, just like I pretend I do not see it. Like
I understand this thing, so I'm gonna call it this thing. Yeah. It's like,
and it's just like they don't even want to consider the possibility. So I'm raising the possibility for people like them.
I really enjoyed that. I thought it was a very like heartwarming part of your book. Like it made me think of other Black ancestors who we can kind of read from that lens and imagine the possibilities.
Yeah, that was my favorite chapter to write. There are all these like lists of people, like historical figures that people are speculating are asexual, like Nikola Tesla and J.M. Barrie, the guy who wrote Peter Pan. And I've never seen a Black person on that list. And so I was like, let me add two.
I like it.
That's all I got for now, but it's enough.
This is great. We want to close out with one last question and like kind of like wrap it up with your final thoughts on what do you hope people will walk away with after reading the book?
One question that I want people to ask themselves is what might your reality look like if you were released from the pressures of performing desirability?
I like that.
Yeah, because the desirability really defines our life in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't get into it a lot in my book because it would have required a whole nother chapter or two chapters in order for me to really tackle it. But just desirability and this idea that we have to present ourselves as sexually desirable to anybody really defines how a lot of people carry themselves, a lot of permissions they give themselves, a lot of restrictions they place on themselves, the way they perform their gender or present. Just, I want people to think about, like, what would your life look like if you could release yourself from that, from feeling obligated to present yourself as sexually desirable?
That's a journal prompt.
Y'all heard that? That question had my brain going, wow.
That's something to meditate onto tonight. Thank you so much, Sharonda. It has been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
Where can folks, if you would like folks to engage with you on the web, where can they engage with you on the web? And where can they buy your amazing, amazing book?
I mean, if you want to follow me, you can follow me on Twitter at Sharonda J. Brown. I probably won't follow you back. Sorry about that.
That's real.
I don't go through my follower list anymore. You can buy my book pretty much anywhere that sells books. I think you can get it. I prefer you buy it from Bookshop because 10% goes to local bookstores and 10% goes to me. And I think that's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
It's also available in ebook format and audiobook format. So it's accessible in that way. Just anywhere but Amazon, basically.
We dig that. We can get behind that. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You.